This exercise that we're supposed to be doing is all about looking at different types of organic structures. So, in fact, after we do this first exercise, there's a series of molecules that we're supposed to convert from condensed formula to full structures. And I would like to go ahead and do that exercise. But like I said, I wanted to review a little bit about line structures first. So, in fact, I'm going to copy the molecule that's on page 138 here into the notes. There are two large biological molecules that are shown, and we're going to take the one on the left, which is LSD. But give me just a minute to copy that into the notes here. As I copy, though, let me review what the method is for writing line structures. So line structures are all about a simplified way of representing carbon-containing compounds. And carbon has a very predictable behavior, which is why we're able to make some of the assumptions that we make when writing line structures. So the first thing is that carbon normally would want to have four bonds to it. So whenever we write carbon structures, we in fact usually leave out the hydrogens that are attached to carbon. And that means when reading the line structure, if you see that there's only one bond being explicitly written to that carbon, then that means there's three hydrogens that aren't being shown. And the reason we automatically assume that is that just happens to be the way that carbon-containing compounds actually behave. That means if you have two bonds explicitly shown to a carbon, there's two hydrogens left on it. Three bonds being shown, there's only one hydrogen on it. And if there's four bonds being shown to the carbon, that means there are no extra hydrogens. There's this term that I don't think I've defined yet, which is heteroatom. So hetero means different, and different than what in this case? Well, different than a hydrocarbon. So a hydrocarbon, if you can remember, is a compound that only contains carbon and hydrogen. So a heteroatom, in the context of an organic molecule, is an atom other than carbon or hydrogen. And you can see in this example structure that we have a few heteroatoms. We've got nitrogens, we've got oxygens, and you can see how one of the nitrogens has a hydrogen that's directly written in, because there is no automatic assumption made for the heteroatoms. You see there is one hydrogen that's coming off of a carbon. So the other rule that I skipped over is that the carbon labels themselves are usually left out. They can be put in certain cases. So, in fact, above the hydrogen I was just about to talk about, we see there's a CH3 group there. Sometimes for really small groups, like a methyl group, which is what that CH3 group is, it makes more sense to write the structure out, or maybe we do it in order to emphasize a bit of structure. So carbon labels are normally left out, but like I said, sometimes they're put in just to highlight what kind of structure is there. Hydrogens on carbons are normally left out, but again, sometimes they're there just to emphasize their presence, or in the case of this one hydrogen that's on the right-hand side of the structure, the reason it's being shown is to show what kind of isomer that we have present. In other words, the fact that we have this wedge line there is trying to show something about the shape of the molecule. So if carbon didn't have four bonds to it, you know, what if it's an exception? There is a way to notate that. So, for example, if a carbon-hydrogen bond were to break, and if the hydrogen left with the electrons, you would have a positive charge left over on the carbon. And so you would write a positive charge next to that carbon, and someone reading that structure would automatically know that there should then only be a total of three bonds present. Opposite way, which is more common what happens, if hydrogen leaves a carbon-hydrogen bond and doesn't take the electrons with it, then that means you're going to end up with a lone pair left behind on carbon, which means carbon will end up with a negative charge. So then we would write a negative charge in, and again, someone reading the structure would automatically know that that means there's only three bonds that should be present on carbon in that case. So what I'd like you to do, and this might take you just a moment, is I want you to take the structure that's written here and try to expand that out to a full structure. So again, everywhere where you see some kind of change in the structure, everywhere where there's a point or a line that's missing an atomic label, that's automatically assumed to be carbon. And then carbon is assumed to have four bonds. So as I was saying earlier, any place that doesn't have a total of four bonds on carbon, we assume there are enough hydrogens there to bring that total up to four. So as an exercise, why don't you go ahead and try to convert this structure into a fully expanded structure. And while you're working on that, I'm going to put into the notes a fully expanded structure, which I'd like you then to try to convert into a line structure. So let's draw out the structure of the top molecule here, and let's start with the carbon framework first. So on the left-hand side, we have these two carbon attachments to the nitrogen. If you recall from our discussion and lecture the other day, I probably had talked about methyl groups before, which are where you have one carbon. These are ethyl groups that are substituents, which are groups of atoms attached to a larger structure. Ethyl groups are substituents that contain two carbons. We've got several rings in this compound. And notice anywhere that we had a double bond in the line structure, that automatically translates into a double bond in the full structure. Any place we had a single bond in the line structure automatically translates to a single line in the full structure as well. So there I've got the carbon backbone. Now let's go back in and make sure we got our heteroatoms all in there. And now let's work on the hydrogens that are attached. So starting on the left, anywhere where you have carbon with just one bond, that means there's going to be three hydrogens attached. So we have a few carbons that are in that situation. Two of them over here on the left. We've got one over here on the right-hand side. Anywhere where carbon has two bonds shown, that means there's two hydrogens present. So there's a couple on the left that are like that. There's one up here on top. One over here on the right-hand side. And I think those are all the ones with just two bonds. Then if you have three bonds showing, then there's only one hydrogen present. So up here, kind of in the top middle, we've got one carbon like that. Right below it, same situation. Down at the bottom left, this ring, several of the carbons there only have three bonds being shown. On the right-hand side, same thing. And then we have several carbons that have four bonds already being shown already. So like up at top here, this double bond with oxygen and then the two other bonds being shown, that brings the total up to four. Several of the carbons in these rings down here also already have four bonds being shown. So there's no extra hydrogens to write in there. Now, I know this is an awful lot of atoms to compare, but how did you all do in writing out the structures? Mostly got it? What about did you have a chance yet to do the line structure, converting the other molecule into line format? All right, so that one's a lot quicker to convert into line structure format. So first, let's do the same thing where we focus on the carbon structure. So we've got a six-membered ring up here at the top with a double bond at the top of the ring. It's fused to another six-membered ring that's got an oxygen in the middle of it. And that's fused to one last ring, which has several double bonds in it. So we've got this tricyclic system, the system with three rings. Up at the top, there's a methyl group that's sticking out. On the bottom right, that would be known as a pentyl group, pent meaning five, so it's a five-carbon chain. On the left-hand side, there are a couple of more methyl groups. We've got the couple of hydrogens being shown with special bonds, so we go ahead and include those. And then there is an OH group that's coming off of one of the rings. So that would be the complete structure in line format. How close did you all get with that line structure? No? Okay. But does it make sense what the answer is seeing it? All right. Now, because we've written these structures out, let's take a minute and see if we can identify functional groups. Because you had a handful of functional groups you were responsible for on the quiz, but we've had a few more functional groups since then. So on this top molecule, are there any functional groups that you all can identify? Say a little louder, sorry. Alcohol. Let's see, for the top one, no, because we don't have any oxygen-hydrogen single bonds. Oh, for the one at the bottom, yes, there's an alcohol there. What about for the top molecule? Well, one group we haven't talked about until recently is the amine functional group. So amines can have hydrogens on the nitrogen, or they can have carbons on the nitrogen. It's more the fact that you have that nitrogen present that makes it an amine. And there are two of the nitrogens here that act as amine functional groups. But there's one more group that is directly connected with a carbon-oxygen double bond, which makes that an amide. So, in fact, this first molecule is LSD, which is lysergic acid diethyl amide. So that amide that's in the name is reflective of the functional group that's here. And then I had mentioned earlier that we have these two ethyl groups. And so the diethyl in the name refers to the fact that these ethyl groups are directly attached to this amide functional group. We do have a couple of alkenes present. And then there's also a benzene ring that's present. So benzene's that special behaving compound where you have electrons that are spread out all throughout the ring. And you might remember me mentioning the term aromatic in lecture. That's a term used to describe the special behavior of benzene and compounds derived from benzene. So this would be considered an aromatic molecule. If we look at the other example molecule that we did, that also contains a benzene ring. It also has an alkene functional group to it. And then one more functional group that might be hard for you to identify, and that is the ether functional group. So an alcohol is whenever you have an oxygen that has a hydrogen attached to it, and an ether is what you have if you only have carbons attached to the oxygen. So this was just supposed to be an exercise in doing line structures, and maybe we'll do a few more next week in getting ready for the exam. Now, following back along with the exercise here, in part A of the exercise we were supposed to do, we were supposed to take some condensed formulas and fill those out to be full structural formulas. And the reason I wanted to go through these is because in simpler text, a lot of times the formulas are represented in this text format instead of using line structures. And I just wanted you to have some idea of how to be able to convert from the text format into a full structure. So first one that's listed is C2H6, which let me make a comment about the number of hydrogens that we would have attached to carbon-containing compounds. So since carbon can always have four bonds with it, that means that if you have a chain of carbons connected one to another, every carbon's going to have two hydrogens on it at least, but then each carbon at the end would have one additional hydrogen to it. So what that means is if you take the number of carbons present, multiply it by two, and add two to it, that's the absolute maximum number of hydrogens that could be possible for that compound, which that is the technical definition of the term saturated. So in class, we had talked about saturated and unsaturated, and the more common usage for those terms is to refer to substances that only have single bonds, if we're talking about saturated, or compounds that might have double or triple bonds, which is what the term unsaturated is used for. But a stricter chemical definition of the term saturated means to have that maximum number of hydrogens possible. So again, if you have just a hydrocarbon, that means two times the number of carbons plus two, which for this example molecule C2H6, that means we have that maximum number of hydrogens. Two times two plus two is six. So that means we can automatically convert this into a full structure, because there's only one way to attach two carbons to each other, and they're both going to have their maximum number of hydrogens. And notice that I've represented this using a full structure instead of a line structure, because the line structure for this molecule would just be a dash. So this is one of those instances where we may go ahead and show a full structure even if we have this line structure system, because sometimes the line structures look a little silly. If we had the molecule methane, which is just CH4, it would just be a dot on the piece of paper, because you wouldn't write the hydrogens and you wouldn't write the carbon. So this is C2H6, which is ethane, relative of butane and propane, so something that could be used as a gas. Now the next example shows how sometimes condensed formulas don't give you enough information. So we have C3H4, which means that the compound doesn't have the maximum number of hydrogens possible. And it turns out there are several possible structures this compound could have. And I'm going to write out a few of those possibilities. One of them is that the compound has a triple bond in it, which means one of the carbons in that triple bond only has one hydrogen, the other has none. And then there's one more carbon left over that would have three hydrogens on it to bring it to the total of four. But there's another way to arrange the carbons and hydrogens as well and still maintain the same formula. And that's if we have the three carbons all in a row and all of the carbons double bonded to each other. That would mean that the central carbon has no hydrogens on it, and then we have the other two carbons that each have two hydrogens on it. Now you notice that the way I drew this compound, two of the hydrogens are in the plane of the paper. That's what the plane line means. And then the other two hydrogens I'm showing with a dash and a wedge. And that just has to do with the structure of what double bond compounds end up existing as. So I've made a model, which you may be able to see where you're sitting. And you might remember that double bonds are a type of bond where you end up with multiple connections between the atoms. And double bonds end up not being able to rotate because of those multiple connections. It turns out that if you have two double bonds attached to one atom, those double bonds are going to automatically be 90 degrees to each other. So because of that, that means hydrogens attached to one double bond are going to be 90 degrees to the other one. Again, in these cases that we have two double bonds that are connected together. So I'm holding the structure right now the same orientation that what we have on the paper. So on your left-hand side, we've got the two hydrogens that are pointed straight up and down. On your right-hand side, I have the hydrogens that are pointed in and out. So these two compounds would be isomers of each other because they're the same formula but different molecules, and they're different functional groups than each other. There's yet one more possibility how we could write this, and that's to make a ring compound. So again, that still maintains the same number of the same types of atoms, but a very different structure. Something that's cyclic, something that has a double bond in it. So condensed structures, like the C3H4, sometimes don't communicate anywhere near enough information for you to be able to determine what kind of molecule it is. And even I, as a chemist, if I had no more additional information, I wouldn't be able to figure out what the molecule is. So I wanted to point that out by going through this example. But in contrast, the next example does show more completely the structure of the molecule. So let me explain the way that this next structure is written out. We see that we've got CH3 and then another carbon written after that. So the reason it's written that way is it's implied then that those three hydrogens are attached to the first carbon, and then that first carbon is attached to the next carbon that's written. Now, after that second carbon, we've got a hydrogen, and then we have things in parentheses. Since that's all written in a line after that second carbon, it's trying to show that all of these different groups are attached to that second carbon. So we wanted to write the structure out. Like I had said, that first carbon is going to have the three hydrogens that are attached to it, and it's attached to the second carbon. And then the second carbon is going to have a hydrogen and then two methyl groups that are attached. So if we wanted to represent this as a line structure, it would be a somewhat simple compound. Much more compactly represented in line structure than in its condensed format. But to come back to the main point, this is an example of something with a condensed formula where you are able to determine exactly what the structure is supposed to be. And that's the same case with a couple other of the structures in this table here. Now, moving on to the next example, C6H6, there's really only one molecule that best fits that formula, and that's the molecule benzene. So I've written this in line structure, but if you examine it, each carbon in benzene has three bonds that are being shown explicitly. The double bond counts for two, the single bond counts for one, and that means that if we wrote that out in full format, each of the carbons would only have one hydrogen on it. So that's C6H6, which a chemist would probably recognize that formula as being benzene. It may be possible that there's other isomers that would have this formula, but this is by far the most common molecule with the formula. Now, the last two examples are other examples where there is enough information to figure out the full structure of the molecule. So, which I just accidentally wrote incorrectly, C2H5OH. Why is one of these hydrogens written separately in the formula from the others? To show that that hydrogen is part of an alcohol. That's why the OH group is written out separately. And with only two carbons in the compound, it doesn't matter which carbon that oxygen might be attached to. So in other words, there's no other way to write this formula out, so we can directly get to the correct structure, which is, in this case, ethanol, the active ingredient in alcoholic beverages. The last example is somewhat similar. CH3C2H5. Why are the carbons and hydrogens on either side of the oxygen written separately from each other? Why are they not all just combined together? To show that the two carbons are connected on either side of that oxygen. And in line structure format, I could write it out like this. A single carbon group on the left, which would be a methyl group. A two-carbon group on the right, which would be an ethyl group. And so this gives us an ether functional group. So did anybody have any questions about the way we did the line structure, the full structure? Anyone have any questions about these examples of taking formulas and expanding them out to structures? If not, let's move on with what the other exercises are supposed to be in Part B here. So there is a new term that's introduced that we did not go over in lecture, and the term is conformer. And that stands for conformational isomer. So a conformational isomer is actually not the same type of isomer that we've discussed before. Our definition of isomers has been that they are different molecules that happen to share the same molecular formula. So a conformational isomer is different structural versions of exactly the same molecule. And these different structures, though, they're ones that differ by only bond rotation. So let me explain what I mean by that. So first of all, you might recall that in lecture I had talked about how carbon, with its four bonds, tends to be tetrahedral in shape. And so if you attach one carbon to another, to another, to another, we automatically end up with these zigzag structures for the molecules. And you could see that in this model that I'm holding, because if I took just one individual carbon, it's tetrahedral in shape. If we somehow connected the ends of the model here, we would have a tetrahedron. And when we connect one of these tetrahedral shapes to another, we automatically get this zigzag conformation out. So that's why in all the examples I have of above, that I've written the molecules in a zigzag format if they're not in a ring format. Now, however, I can take this model, and you can see it's easy for me to swing part of the structure around because the single bonds rotate. Single bonds only have a single connection between the atoms, so they can rotate freely past each other. Double bonds with their multiple connections don't allow that rotation. Well, what significance is there to the fact that this can rotate around? Well, this model is somewhat inaccurate because it's representing things in a stick format. It's just trying to show what the outline of the structure is. But if you can remember from a few weeks back, we had talked about orbitals, these spaces that electrons can exist in. The orbitals fill up a fair amount of space around each atom. So there's a different form of model that's called a space-filling model, where you use their spheres or balls that try to represent that area where the electrons are going to exist. This model doesn't happen to show that. So what ends up happening is that as this turns around, the bottoms of the model that I'm holding right now, these methyl groups, you could say, they'd actually be bumping into each other slightly because of the space that the electrons would actually be occupying. And that, of course, electrons are negatively charged. So if you have electrons interacting with other electrons, that would be negative charge that's bumping into negative charge, which is not favorable. So you end up with what's called a steric interaction. Steric comes from the word stereo, which makes us think about left and right, but stereo actually means to deal with shape. So steric has to do with the fact that there's a repulsion that can occur when different parts of a molecule interact with each other. So if I have the two ends of the molecule lined up like this, where they're both pointing the same direction as each other, they end up with this steric interaction. If I twist it around 180 degrees where the two groups are completely opposite of each other, then they don't have that steric interaction. And that can matter in real life in chemical reactions because molecules will often adopt a geometry that avoids that steric interaction because that bumping it together of electron clouds causes the molecule to be at higher energy. So this is the same molecule that I'm just twisting the bond around, and that's exactly what a conformational isomer is. So conformational isomers we sometimes look at in order to figure out, well, what shape would the molecule really want to adopt, and therefore, how would that molecule want to react? Now, let me just copy this model onto the page so I can show you how conformational isomers might be represented. So the way that I have the model configured right now, where the two ends of the molecule are pointed opposite each other. If I just hold the molecule in front of me like this, all of the carbon-carbon bonds I have in the zigzag here, and then on the middle two carbons, there are the hydrogens that are pointed towards me or away from me. So if I wanted to copy that into the structure or onto paper, I could do it like this. So I could use those dashes and wedges to show hydrogens pointed towards me or pointed away from me. That's one way of visualizing the molecule. Another way to do it is like this. Imagine that I'm looking at the molecule from the end along this middle carbon-carbon bond. If I put it down on paper, you might be able to see what I'm describing here. So the shadow's not helping all that much, but what you'd end up with is three of the bond lines that are on the top here are in sort of a triangular arrangement, and in between each of these, we can see three bonds that are down below, also in a sort of triangular arrangement. And so one other way of visualizing on paper is to pretend that we're taking a viewpoint like that from the side of the molecule, and we pretend that there's like a type of disc in between the two parts of the bond there. And we write what's called a projection. So in the front here, we would see the hydrogens pointing to one side or the other, this methyl group being right in line with my viewpoint. And in back, there's another carbon that would be pointed up, along with the hydrogens that are pointed side to side. So this kind of projection can be used to more clearly see that the two methyl groups are pointed opposite each other, and that would be a lower energy conformation. Now, if I rotate the molecule around 180 degrees, and now look at the model, see what I have, from front to back, the bonds are now lined up with each other. Again, it's kind of hard to see this with the shadows going on here. But I have one bond in front that's lined in line with the one that's in back. Same thing with the other side here. And so let me draw that molecule on the page in line structure format. So this is the way it would appear. So again, hydrogens on both carbons pointing the same way out, hydrogens on both carbons pointing the same way in, these two methyl groups also in line with each other. And if I wanted to draw a projection, we would see in that projection that from front to back, the atoms are stacked on top of each other. That's exactly what creates this steric interaction I was mentioning earlier, which would cause that version of the molecule to be at higher energy. So why would that matter? Well, because at room temperature, there's enough energy that the single bonds are able to freely rotate, even though as each time the two methyl groups come together, there would be some small amount of resistance that would occur. But if you cool off the molecule enough, you get to the point where this steric interaction ends up taking too much energy compared to what's available based on the temperature. So in other words, the molecule would no longer be able to freely rotate around, which means it would affect how the molecule is able to react. So that's why these conformational isomers actually matter. Knowing that different formats of the same molecule could exist at different energies helps us predict how it's going to behave. So your lab exercise mentions these conformers, which we hadn't talked about at all yet in lecture. And this is the easiest form of conformer to describe, which is looking at what happens as a single bond rotates around. Now, ring compounds can also have conformers. More complex molecules can have other types of conformers. But as I just said, this is the easiest one for us to try to understand. So it's the only one that we're going to cover today. Now, in the same section, it also gets into types of isomers, which I'd like to review the types of isomers again, because on the quiz, all you had to know was what isomers are. But since we've had a chance to review, I would like you to now know a couple of the different types of isomers. So one type of isomer are what are known as constitutional isomers. And these are isomers that have the same molecular formula, but different bond conductivity. Meaning that different atoms are hooked up to different atoms. One easy example, if I have C6H12. That could be a compound that's a simple ring, what's known as cyclohexane. Hex means six, so that's a six-carbon compound. Cyclo means that it's cyclic. It could also be the molecule hexene. Again, hex meaning six, and the ene part of the name showing that it's got an alkene in it. So both of them, same molecular formula, but they would have very different behavior. The double bond, the hexene compound, would be much more reactive than the cyclohexane. So another example, if we have C2H6O, well, that could be ethanol. Earlier we had seen C6H5OH. Now I've combined the hydrogens together to make an even more simplified structure, but now we're back to a situation where it doesn't fully show what the structure could be, because I also could write a structure where I have oxygen in the middle and then carbons on either side and would give me the same number of atoms. But an ether has very different behavior than an alcohol. So these would be structural or constitutional isomers.
How do you know where the double bond goes in the alkene?
You don't. I just chose a version of hexene. So the question that was asked is, how do I know where the double bond goes? And I just chose one example of what hexene could look like. Now, since you asked that question, it is mentioned, I think, in the text at some point that there's a way to say where the double bonds in a compound are located. So, for example, this would be called 1-hexene, because if I numbered the carbons, starting with the closest carbon to that double bond, you could see that the carbon number one is part of that double bond. So we name the compound 1-hexene to show that that's exactly where the double bond is. The compound 2-hexene would have a double bond that goes from carbons 2 to 3 instead. So there is a way to tackle how to specify which molecule you have. Now, the other type of isomer that we have talked about is a stereoisomer. And those are molecules with same bond connectivity, meaning the same atoms are attached to the same atoms, but they have different 3D geometric arrangement, which makes it sound an awful lot like conformational isomers. Conformational isomers are ones where all you do is rotate a single bond. This is a little different, though, because even though you have things attached to the same atoms, you end up with molecules that are not equivalent to each other. And one of the classic examples is exactly the type of example that's shown in your lab text, where if you have a single carbon, a tetrahedral carbon, where you have four different groups attached to it. So it turns out, just automatically, when you have tetrahedral geometry, that there end up being two unique ways that we could put four attachments on a molecule. So if you're able to see from where you're sitting, you could see that I've got four different color substituents attached to the central carbon. If you can't quite see from where you're sitting, I'll put this on the overhead. And they look very similar to each other. They're, in fact, mirror images of each other, just in the same way that your two hands are essentially mirror images of each other. But in that same way, if instead of holding your hands just parallel to each other like this to show that they're mirror images, if you try to put one hand on top of the other, of course they don't end up being the same shape. Just like if you take a left-handed glove, it's not going to fit very well likely on your right hand. So if I take these two models and I try to line up two of the atoms to make the molecules try to overlap, you'll see that the other two atoms don't overlap with each other, meaning that there are two different molecules from each other. And I've already talked about a few examples in class where this matters. I think the other day I started talking about glucose, blood sugar, the fact that it's actively metabolized only in one of its mirror image forms. Later on today, if we get to that point, we'll talk about enzymes, where I've already mentioned in class that enzymes have a particular shape that depend on molecules having a particular shape to interact with them. There's another example that I pulled out the other day, which is a plant-based example. So this is the line structure for the molecule limonene. And it turns out there's two different mirror image forms of the molecule. The one on the left is the major form that gives lemons or limes part of their characteristic odor. The one on the right smells a bit more like turpentine, which is a type, think of paint remover, something that has that more of that kind of smell. The reason the two molecules smell differently is because whatever sites that we have in our nose where molecules can attach, well, these have slightly different shapes. So they end up provoking different kinds of sensations, even though all they are mirror images from each other. So this is one form of stereoisomer, where you have this different 3D arrangement. And let me just copy into the notes this example that I talked about of having four different substituents around carbon. That if you were to build models yourself that look like this, those represent two unique ways of arranging those substituents, which will turn out to produce two unique kinds of molecules. Now, let me back up here to the limonene for a moment, because the limonene is what's known as a terpene. Terpenes are biological molecules that are assembled using five carbon structures that have this shape to them. So it's four carbons in a line with a fifth carbon that's splintered off from that four carbon chain. And the technical name for that group is an isoprene unit. So biologically, a huge class of molecules are all assembled by either plants or animals from these five carbon units in different ways. So in fact, if we go back and look at limonene, we can chop the structure up into two of these five carbon units. It turns out that much larger molecules, including things like cholesterol or estrogen, they're also made from starting materials that are also built this exact same way, out of terpene units. So terpenes cover a huge number of compounds that are responsible for the flavors or odors that are in plants. They're also responsible for important molecules that are found in humans, like the two I mentioned earlier, estrogen or cholesterol. I did mention that in context, the only place where you might have heard of terpenes is there's an awful lot of discussion around them involving marijuana plants because of the different proportions of these terpenes that are found in different strains. But I just wanted to point out that the term terpene is actually a much broader used term. And it's used for any of these molecules, like limonene, that are created from these five carbon units. So terpenes, that's not a form of isomer, but because I've used limonene as an example, I just wanted to be able to talk about terpenes briefly. Now, these mirror image type molecules are just one kind of stereoisomer. There is another type of stereoisomer that we've seen in double bonds, and that's the cis-trans isomer. So I had another pair of example molecules that's frequently used in organic chemistry to discuss this other form of stereoisomer. So these are two different carboxylic acids. We can recognize carboxylic acids by the fact that we have this carbon-oxygen double bond that has an OH group attached to it. And in one of these cases, you can see that the two carboxylic acids are pointed the same direction off of a double bond. In the other case, they're pointed in opposite directions. That double bond does not allow rotation around it, so these are permanently locked in these structures. And the one where they're both pointed the same direction is known as cis. The one where they're pointed in opposite directions is known as trans. And without looking it up, I don't remember which one is which, but one of these is a solid at room temperature, the other is a liquid. So the fact that they have different stereoisomers, different structures, means they can have very different physical properties from each other. And they would also have a different reactivity than each other. Now the question came up in the other section, is this the only place where these cis-trans terms are used? And so I did show for them that no, the terms do end up getting used in other instances as well. So for example, if we have a ring compound and we have two substituents on that ring, that are pointed the same direction. So you see that I've used these wedge lines to show two different groups, both pointed at us, both pointed the same direction. So the term cis could also be used in that case as well. Or a similar molecule where the groups are pointed in opposite directions from each other would be called trans. But the more common way to use these cis and trans terms are for double bonds, which in class I'd mentioned, those are one biological example is in cis and trans fats. So cis fats versus trans fats all have to do with how the double bonds are configured, which affects both how they react. Cis fats end up being more reactive than trans fats, and it also affects how they're shaped. So even this in this example of the carboxylic acids, you can see how the cis form appears to be a bit more compact, the trans form a bit more spread out, and in a similar manner, that's why trans fatty acids tend to be the ones that are less beneficial for us, because they tend to have a broader shape. That means that they have a better chance of being able to clog up our blood vessels. So referring back to this exercise, we've tackled part A, where we were supposed to look at different structures. We tackled B, which is where we're supposed to look at isomers and conformers. Part C, we talked about structural and stereoisomers. We've already talked about functional groups, which was what we were supposed to do in part D. And then part E, I wasn't even able to do my own self, because we were supposed to build models from these diagrams that are in the text, and I can't tell exactly which atoms they were supposed to have us use. So that's why I ended up doing this exercise as a discussion instead, because I thought that would end up being more beneficial for us.